hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 105 of the No Better Than Average podcast. I am Jeff Chaney, and along with me today, as always, is Todd Singer. Todd, how you doing?
I am pissed off.
Okay, whoa, easy.
Right out of the gate with the language?
Wow. We got problems in this country. Oh, I told you I ordered a new LG V20 from Newegg a couple weeks ago, and I praised Newegg.
You did?
And they let you down.
Thursday the 10th, it was supposed to ship November 11th. On Thursday the 10th, I got a notice from Newegg saying your order is being processed, and then it said your credit card has been charged successfully. And then on November 11th, I got a message saying your order has shipped. And I looked at the tracking. Oh, it shipped from Indianapolis.
Oh, so you should get
be here
no
anytime.
Time. Yeah.
Now I have a PO box set up at a UPS store in Brownsburg where I work. Helps me do some political stuff that I won't bore you with. So I had it sent there. I was hoping I would get it the Friday, but it didn't. It got to a FedEx location in Zionsville. So okay. I thought, okay, well, this is going to be a bummer. It's going to come on Saturday. I'll have to decide, do I drive from a couple towns over to this place? And you know what? They missed the delivery on Saturday. So it was on a FedEx vehicle at 8:29. I'm looking at the tracking record now. Now, for those of you not in the greater Indianapolis area, Zionsville is 14 and a half miles from Brownsburg. They finally made it to Brownsburg at 3 o'clock p.m. on a Saturday, and it said, delivery exception, customer not available, or business closed. So they couldn't make it 14 and a half miles in, what is that, 7 hours.
Well, I'm sure they had other stops between.
Perhaps. So it says, a customer not available or business closed, recommended action, delivery will be reattempted the next business day.
That would be Monday.
Which is Monday.
We're recording this on Monday, November 14th, which, as far as I know, is a business day. And they did not attempt to deliver again. Do you know what that is, gentlemen? That is fraud. I think we need to call them Fraud X from now on. And I'm going to have to write a kindly worded letter to Newegg telling them to cease using FedEx anymore. I don't have this issue with UPS or even the U.S. Post Office. What is going on?
I mean, does Newegg care? Like, are they actually going to put a note in your file that says, please don't send Todd shipments FedEx?
If they get 100,000 notes, they'll care.
I
can only do my part.
I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that with Amazon, they started using a like little local delivery service that I had like three issues in a row with. Of them not delivering it on time or saying I wasn't there when I was there. And I called Amazon and complained, and they will no longer use that company for me.
Really?
Yeah. They were like, okay, we will never use that company ever again. So, I don't know if Newegg would do that, but I know Amazon did for me.
I had an issue recently where I needed something and ordered it, and it was supposed to be delivered guaranteed on Wednesday, and Wednesday came and went. And it was not delivered, and it was shipped USPS from Amazon. And I contacted Amazon's chat, and they expedited it and promised it would be delivered on Thursday of last week, and it was. And I asked them to please make sure that they did not send shipments via USPS, and they said, sorry, we can't do that. But with that, if it's the same company, I don't know if it is. I think it's Laser Track or Laser Ship. which delivers probably better than 50%. Yes, Todd is air quoting around laser. I'd say they probably deliver close to 50% of the packages that we get from Amazon now. They've actually been great for us. I was out working in the yard a few months ago, and the laser ship guy drove up in his van to drop off a package and even commented to me as I was outside working, "Man, you sure get a lot of Amazon packages." And so he's up in our neighborhood like all the time. Which probably okay, means so that I get too much from Amazon.
Still not through the intros, and we're 10 minutes in. And that other person that's been talking is Jacob.
Hey, everybody.
How you doing, Jacob?
How's it going, Jacob?
I am doing great. You know, I was off work all last week. I was working on my big Christmas show, and I had to actually get up and go back to the real world this week, this morning. It's Monday, and I've just decided that I really need to be independently wealthy so I don't have to get up and go back to the real world. It was a little rough getting started today.
I have not been getting up and going to the real world now for over a week.
It's probably nice.
Quick.
It's not old for me yet.
Well, that's because you had things to do. Like, I've been doing things. I've had a honey-do list, but it just, I don't know. Yeah. No human action during the day is a little rough sometimes.
That is true. And, you know, fortunately my wife usually works out of the home, so I've got her around to keep me company, and so it was nice last week, and I really was not ready to get back into the swing of it this week. So other than that, I am spectacularly good.
Rest of the intro stuff. We always appreciate call-ins on our comment line, 317-643-1212. You can speak to a computer like God intended and leave us any kind of feedback you would like. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nobettershow.com/join. Support the show on Patreon. We would appreciate any scratch you could send our way at www.patreon.com/nobettershow. I think that takes care of it. We can jump in, or we can continue talking about FedEx and why they blow. Whatever.
You know, I do have to say that we got an email this past week, or I think we actually got a tweet from listener Kai, who basically found an article that says that you, and I believe it was Howie from last week, were wrong about the MacBook Pro. Apparently, the word on the street is that the new MacBook Pro has already outsold all competing laptops this year. And it's only been out for 3 weeks now? Or that was 3 weeks ago was the announcement. And he sent over a link to an article that said that that it's already outsold all competing laptops, according to data shared by research firm Slice Intelligence, which I think might be that same company that makes the Slice app that I believe that we've talked about on this show in the past, where we'll analyze.
That's what they do to make their money.
Right. And they analyze your emails. And they say that the data they have accumulated shows that from revenue from online orders during the first 5 days of availability of the new MacBook Pro, the one that has been solidly poo-pooed by Jeff and by Howie, has outsold the Microsoft Surface Book, the Asus Chromebook Flip, the Dell Inspiron 2-in-1, the Lenovo Yoga 900, based on e-receipt data from almost 13,000 online shoppers in the United States, and has generated over 7 times the revenue of the 12-inch MacBook over its first 5 days of availability. Apparently, Phil Schiller from Apple came out and said that the MacBook Pro had received more online orders than any previous MacBook Pro as of November 2nd, and has apparently reportedly told overseas manufacturers to expect a strong MacBook Pro shipments to continue until the end of 2016. So I know that there's been a pretty vocal crowd of podcasters who have poo-pooed it, including Jeff and some of our listeners, criticizing the notebook's lack of ports and limited RAM. But Schiller said that the early criticism debate has been a bit of a surprise to them, but common for any new Apple product. So, I mean, what to make of this, Jeff? I mean, obviously it's selling.
So I think a couple things. I think that just because something sells doesn't defend some of the choices they made. Is it still one of the best laptops out there that you can buy? Yeah, it is. But could it have been better? Absolutely. And I think that's the thing. It's like, I don't think they should hold up sales data as defense of their engineering. Well, first of all, if you want OS, if you want Mac OS, OS X, you don't have any choice. You're going to buy that or you're not going to buy anything, right?
True. True.
So it's not necessarily fair for them to defend it this way. Now, I think the other thing is that there are a lot of quote-unquote professionals who don't need more than 16 gigabytes of RAM, who don't need an SD card slot, who will be just fine having those dongles. But my point was not that they wouldn't sell them. My point is that there is still a niche of a market that Apple does not seem to be addressing at all anymore. And those are professionals, not me included. Like, this machine for me would be fine. I mean, I wouldn't like all the dongles, but it would be fine. Mm-hmm. I don't do a bunch of video editing. I don't do a bunch of photo editing. I just, you know, I don't do that stuff. But there is a very large, a very, very vocal, small minority of people who were true professionals. The Alex Lindsay of Mac, you know, MacBreak Weekly, you know, people that are actually doing professional work that want to use these machines and they can't,
right?
Because they're powerful enough, they won't do what they need them to do, they don't have enough connectivity. And that's obviously Apple is moving away from serving that niche, and you know, I guess that's okay, but that's where, I mean, that those are the people that kept Apple in business for years and years and years when no one else was.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, it just feels like to me Apple is becoming more of a consumer company. Hey, for Apple, that's probably a great thing because they're probably making a higher margin on this device. They're probably selling a ton of them to people that, quite honestly, don't need anything more powerful. Good for them. But I just think to leave that niche of people that kept you going for so long high and dry, it just seems like to me if they would have added one more SKU, a 15-inch that had the four ports, was a little thicker, had 32 gigabytes of RAM, you know, had a couple other ports on there, I think that would have gone a long way.
Right.
I just feel like they're turning their backs on those people. That person is not me. I am not that person. So the new MacBook, except for the price, would suit me just fine.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do any of the things that, but I just, for me, at this point, I don't know that I see the need for a laptop anymore. I've probably bought my last laptop. I'll get it. I'm not saying I won't have a desktop because I still like having a place to go sit. I just don't know that I need a laptop. I think I could get by with an iMac that would be cheaper than one of these new MacBook Pros and just as powerful, if not more so, and you know, would suit me just fine. And then have my iPad Pro for when I want to sit in front of the TV. And that's fine.
And that's a pretty compelling combination, and I've noticed that over the last few months I have used my laptop less and less. I've spent more time on my Mac Mini at my desk for, you know, podcast related things and, you know, putting the show together and doing some photo editing and things like that. And, you know, really my laptop on the lap in front of the TV on the couch has slowly evolved into the iPhone Plus, the 7 Plus on, you know, in my hands in front of the TV, which could easily be supplanted with an iPad. And in fact, I use a service called CrashPlan, which is an online backup, kind of like Carbonite. And I got an email alert from them the other day that said, hey, just a heads up, but your MacBook Pro hasn't been backed up in like 15 days. And we're sending you an alert to let you know so that you can check and find out what's wrong with it and get it back online and backing up. And it made me realize I haven't had my laptop on and running long enough in 15 days for it to connect and phone home for CrashPlan. And I honestly haven't really noticed that I haven't used it in 2 weeks. So, yeah, I mean, unless I was in a position where I had to go out and be, you know, a power user on the road, I don't know that another laptop is necessarily in my future either. Not at the prices anyway. I mean, I got this Mac Mini for like $499, and it's plenty of machine for 90% of what I do. There's 10% of the time I wish it was a little bit more powerful, but it still does what I need it to do. It's just not as quick as I would like it to be. So
if they would have upgraded the Mac Mini in the last 2 years, it would be powerful enough.
Absolutely. Being the 2014 model, it's still, it's powerful enough. Again, 90% of the time, it's fine.
90% of the time, it's fine. But, you know, it just goes back to, I mean, they're they're letting some things get old. And, you know, the Mac Pro, even worse, I think it's 3 years.
Something like that.
I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, it's just a different business model, I think. And I don't know if it's the right one or not.
Go
ahead, Todd.
Sorry, I have a 2011 Windows laptop, and I will probably be investing in another one in a year or two because I like to play games. And so I budget a couple $1,000s for a good gaming laptop that I can, you know, take to a hotel, and after everybody's asleep, I can game for a couple hours. I also use it every year for our fantasy football draft with, you know, Microsoft Excel, keep track of all the bids and all the players to all the teams. So I've got a couple of uses that'll keep me in the laptop market for years and years.
And I totally understand that. Like, I mean, the gaming side of it, notwithstanding, since I'm not really a PC gamer, you know, that's not a compelling piece for me. But I totally get the portability for being able to, you know, drag it out and have a real computer, you know, when you're out doing a fantasy football draft or something like that. That makes total sense. And
you could totally do your fantasy football draft on an iPad Pro.
Probably. Totally. Or a Chromebook.
Does it have a keyboard?
Yes.
Will it boot into Windows so I can use Excel in Windows? Because Excel on a Mac sucks ass.
You can use Excel on an
iPad. No, I cannot. I've tried, and none of the keyboard shortcuts work right. It's terrible. It's a horrible product. I will never do it again.
It's not that
Apple
bad.
Ruins everything. I was sitting beside someone at our chili supper at the elementary school, and they would have sworn I'd never used Excel before. And I'm in Excel hours and hours every day at my job. So, no, never again.
You know,
if the MacBook Pro will boot into Windows so that I could run Excel under Windows, then yes, I could use it.
Does Apple still maintain Boot Camp? I haven't investigated that in forever. So, technically, you could buy the hardware and boot into Windows.
Sure.
You'd
be better off just get, like, one of the little VMware.
Yeah.
It's just more convenient, but yeah.
You say that, but you know, for a fantasy football draft, Excel on the Mac, friggin' Google spreadsheet would be fine.
No, it's
you
an
do
auction.
Not need the power of Excel.
You need, yes, you do. It's an auction.
He has macros and stuff. It's
you don't.
It's all
need
linked.
That. You don't need that. You just need but some paper
even
and
if
some
I don't
dice.
Need it. It's already set up. It's already ready to go. I just boot Excel. Change the year to the next year, and we're ready to go. And actually, the software I use to draft is Excel with macros.
Right.
You just need a couple of 20-sided dice and a paladin and a mage, because let's face it, you're playing adult D&D. You're playing jock D&D.
Our league is $100 auction league, and we draft the day before Labor Day. So can I count you in, Jacob?
No, because that would mean I would have to pay attention to the football.
No, you don't. All you need is a 20-sided die and a paladin. You'll do great.
I could tell we've hit a nerve. Anyway, moving on to something a little more awe-inspiring. The robots are coming to kill us all. I just saw this literally minutes before we got in here to record. I saw a video. There is now a robot that will solve a Rubik's Cube in 0.637 seconds. And there is a video out there, which I will link to. But it is it's built by a company that makes, I believe, chips called, and I'm trying to pull the link up here as I look at it.
Infineon or something
like that? Yeah, Infineon. Did you guys see this video?
I just watched it.
Insane. Infineon chips, they have built this robot, and it solves it. And when you watch it, it's just a blur, and then it's, you know, a six-sided, all the same color. And they show it again, I think, in 12 times slow motion. And by golly, it is really flipping and flopping it, and it's solving it in, you know, 637 thousandths of a second. It is insane. I will put a link in the show notes.
Just to give that, you know, some context, the fastest human solver, 4.9 seconds.
Yeah, which admittedly is fast. I mean, I think I solved a Rubik's Cube once and it took me like an hour and a half. And I know that they're really fast for human solvers. And I also know that I think that there's an algorithm that you can apply to solving a Rubik's Cube. And I think any of the four quadrillion face combinations can be solved in, it's like 23 moves or less if you know the right pattern. I do not know the right pattern. I have some friends on Facebook who have applied themselves and gotten down to being able to solve a Rubik's Cube in 10 or 15 seconds, which to me, that's insanely fast. But this video is nuts.
Not even close to the world record.
No, no, not at all. But now, you know, like I said, six thousandths of a second or something like that, or 600,000ths of a second.
People that are really into Rubik's Cubes don't even do 3x3x3 Rubik's Cubes. Those are for wusses.
I consider me a wuss because I have never put the time in to try and master it. But I feel like if they're building machines that are capable of doing this, they're probably building machines somewhere in a lab that are capable of crushing our skulls. So, yeah, you got to check it out.
Way less than 637,000ths of a second.
To crush my skull? Oh, absolutely.
I'll be way quicker than that.
We can build a quality skull-crushing robot. I'm sure of that. So that's one of my quickies. And another quick quickie is, I don't know if either of you have had a chance to get your hands on a Pixel XL yet, but one of my coworkers just got one, and I had a chance to play with it a little bit today. And I've got to tell you, it's really, really nice. Interestingly, sitting on the desk side by side with my iPhone 7 Plus, if the angle is just right, they look like they are the same phone. Other than the home button on the iPhone, they are, from all outward appearances, just identical inside of a case. The build quality is really, really nice and solid. The button it has is on the back is the fingerprint reader, which is kind of an odd placement. I felt like it was not comfortable for me to use. And interestingly enough, my coworker didn't even realize that there was a fingerprint reader on the back. Did not have it set up to read fingerprints. And after I said, "Oh no, this is the fingerprint reader," they fiddled with it and turned it on and were quite impressed at the ability to biometrically unlock their device. Played around a little bit with the launcher that comes with it that is entirely. Todd, you could probably speak to more detail of what Google is doing with it, but it's really nice. Probably not as nice as Nova Launcher, but you know, seemed to work really well. It was really fast. You can swipe over into the Google Assistant stuff, which looked really cool. I'm assuming that that's still the plan, is eventually that's going to roll out to other Android devices. The camera was incredibly responsive. I have to say, I was really shocked at how Apple-esque the camera experience was. And, you know, obviously inside of an office, it was kind of hard to do anything to put the camera through its paces. I've read a little bit online about the Pixel camera and seen some pictures and whatnot, and it's a decidedly nice mobile camera, but it was fast. It was easy to change the settings. I mean, I think Apple really needs to be paranoid. I mean, for Google's first foray into, you know, their device, the Google device, man, if I had to go tomorrow and buy another phone that was not an iPhone, it would be a Pixel. There is no doubt about it. I'm really impressed.
I just want to point out, you asked if either of us have had the chance to see one, and unless my dogs ordered one and are playing with it on the couch, the chance of me having seen one, zero.
Well, I mean, you could have gone to a Verizon store for some reason, being a T-Mobile customer. Some of that human interaction that you're craving.
The camera is getting really good reviews from people who use it because it's so quick. And
lightning.
People were really questioning whether they needed OIS, but it captures the image so fast that they're not needing it, and they're getting great shots.
Yeah, and again, I mean, playing with it inside of a typical office space with fluorescent lighting, it was really tough to tell if the picture I was taking was better than the picture coming out of my iPhone. But I'll tell you, I mean, I know that one of the things that Google touted at their press release, a month or so ago, was they called it, and they said the words, zero shutter lag. Now, I'm sure that is still measured in, you know, milliseconds. But I mean, by golly, you push the button and the image was acquired. I mean, it was as instantaneous as I've ever seen on a mobile device. I mean, I've never felt like shutter lag has been an issue on the iPhone. And I mean, like I said, I would put the experience of using the Pixel camera and software right up there with the iPhone. Admittedly, this comes from 10 minutes of fiddling with it, but I mean, in 10 minutes, I was like, seriously, seriously impressed. And like I said, if I were to drop my iPhone in the turlet and had to go get something else, and I couldn't get an Apple device, it would be a Pixel. A Pixel XL is pretty darn nice. I thought I'd throw that out since we had talked a little bit about it, but I didn't think any of us had actually had a chance to touch one yet. But yeah, very, very nice device. What other stories you guys want to tackle? We've got a whole bunch in the notes here. Jeff, you want to talk about Samsung buying Harman? Is it Harman Kardon or just
Harman.
Harman. So what's the difference between the two?
Okay, well, one owns the other. So Samsung is buying audio maker Harman for $8 billion. Brands that Harman own include JBL, Harman Kardon, okay. Mark Levinson, okay. AKG, Lexicon, Infinity, and Revel. They are mostly buying Harman for their automotive segment, which accounts for 65% of the company's revenue.
Wow.
They currently are in 30 million vehicles globally. Some of their expertise are in mobility, semiconductors, the user experience, and displays, and have several long-term relationships with leading car makers, including like Infiniti, Nissan. I can't remember. I saw a list and then I couldn't find it again, but several leading, you know, big car manufacturers that they deal with. Samsung is planning on keeping Harman as a standalone Samsung subsidiary. The current CEO, Dinesh Paliwal, is set to remain at the helm, and they're hoping to close the deal by mid-2017. Interestingly enough, they also have some IoT space, next-gen cloud-based stuff that they're looking to pull into the fold. Apparently, they have some consumer and enterprise experiences along the Lexicon, the Mark Levinson, and the Revel brand. I'm not familiar with any of them, but that's what I found on that. So, you know, Samsung trying to get into the automobile market, maybe, you know, making that play for, you know, a segment of the automotive market that Apple may be looking at in one way or the other. I think Samsung tries to keep up with the Joneses, as it will. So I'm not sure how Samsung's pulling out $8 billion right now with the help having, but hey, good on them.
They just sold some more tanks. What the heck?
So, is this an in run around like CarPlay and the Android equivalent? Get the Samsung software right onto the head unit itself.
Yeah, I think that's the play. They're trying to become a third, you know,
option
player in the car head unit realm.
Samsung is supposed to have some of their own AI in the S8. So yeah, they're obviously trying to have their own kind of Google Assistant system.
Did they buy the same people that did Siri originally?
Is that the new
company? And I think that Samsung just bought that company.
I think it was it Nuance that did Siri originally? So that's interesting. You said that 65% of Harman's revenue comes from the automotive segment because, you know, the brands that you listed, like JBL and Harman Kardon and Mark Levinson, and I mean, I know those as, you know, home theater stuff more than I would think of car audio. But, like, does Harman also make, the systems for OEMs that just don't – are they rebranded or something like that? Do you know?
Yeah, in Infiniti are branded as Infiniti, and I think Nissan. This is me basing it on. I've owned a Nissan before that had an Infiniti system. I know JBL makes subwoofers,
right,
big in that world. I don't know that Harman Kardon is in the car space that I know of, but they may be doing branded stuff for. I mean, if you're in 30 million vehicles, it's probably a lot of it is just OEM stuff that they're making for car.
Right. Yeah, because I think my car is a Pioneer. It's like a GMC / Pioneer hybrid custom unit for GMC.
I've met somebody who works for Harman, and he hasn't have anything to do with automotive, I don't think, but they did a bunch of work for like Lucas Oil Stadium. He travels around to like large sound systems and, you know, either troubleshoots or designs. Hey, this is how we're going to install all this stuff. So they obviously have some type of a commercial sound enterprises as well.
Oh, sure. That's interesting. And it also looks like you've got a story in here about a new supercomputer from Cray.
Yeah. So Cray just is currently installing their first XC50 supercomputer.
I didn't even know Cray was still making computers.
Oh, yeah. And that's being installed at the Swiss National Supercomputer Center. Spelled funny because they're in Europe. Cray. It does one petaflop of computing in one cabinet.
Oh, wow.
So kind of small for a lot of data crunching. They're using a combination of NVIDIA Tesla P100 GPU accelerators, along with next-gen Intel Xeon and Xeon Pi processors.
Okay. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Doesn't mean anything to me either, but it's actually more GPUs than it is CPUs.
I think that's kind of the way some of these supercomputers are going, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The uses are for things like deep learning algorithms, weather system simulations, quantum chemistry, organic brain activity at low levels, like AI. And that's a lot of petaflop in one small cabinet.
Wow.
Yeah,
I thought it was kind of... looks cool. I found a picture of it.
It looks really cool.
I've read that a lot of the latest artificial intelligence is running on GPU platforms, like Jeff just alluded to.
Yeah.
Especially, I've seen that like in the medical field. So a lot of the AI they're using to run, you know, genomes and such, they're using NVIDIA GPU chips.
I know it was about 2, maybe 3 years ago at this point, probably right before we started the podcast. I think it was the summer before, so it would have been in 2014. That was the summer that Bitcoin exploded and everybody was going nuts over cryptocurrencies. And I did a little bit of digging into it. And at the time, the thing to do was to basically get a chassis. There were companies selling chassis that would hold GPUs, and people would just stuff like a half dozen to a dozen GPUs inside of a chassis. They'd literally have like 2, 3, 4 PC power supplies in there, and it had a board that literally had just enough brains on it to power up these GPUs and basically feed them units to crunch on for the cryptocurrencies. And you could buy one of these chassis, stuff it with GPUs, and control it from your computer like a Raspberry Pi, and it would download and feed it chunks of the blockchain to solve so that you could try and unlock and mine for bitcoins. And I know that that even went the direction of customized what do they call it, application specific integrated chips, ASICs, for the Bitcoin mining and such. But that was all GPU based because CPUs just couldn't touch the calculations, and the GPUs could crunch through them like it was their job. And I know that that's really the, kind of the way some of this really beefy processing has gone lately. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I read an article in the Patrick Cox's Tech Digest. And video game science opens the door to life extension. This is from October 17th. He talks about traditional computing chips were not very good at responding. The CPUs excel at performing instructions in the order they are given. So that works for applications like word processors, database, and operating systems, but not huge interactive virtual environments, you know, like big MMOs. Mm-hmm. And GPUs were invented to meet the needs of video games. And they model the rules of physics so that games can function as if the actions are taking place in the real world. Hmm. So, yeah, that's maybe the way things are going. It's also a reason that Intel kind of dropped the ball, right? They're great at CPUs, but NVIDIA is king of GPUs right now, anyway. In fact, he pointed out the first chip marketed as a GPU was a GeForce 256 in 1999 from a small company named NVIDIA.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that GeForce had been around that long. Man, it makes me feel old. that's kind of cool stuff.
Mostly research centers and universities are who are still using computer, you know, supercomputers.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, you have to build very specific applications to take advantage of that power. I mean, if you're not writing software very specifically for the way those supercomputers work, you're not getting the bang for the vast amounts of millions of dollars that you're putting into them. And, I mean, I know that they model, you know, weather and nuclear explosions and all sorts of stuff that's really hard to model, and there's a whole, you know, there's a whole process of how you write software to scale on those type of systems. I don't know anything about the process, but I know that there is one. That's cool. I always wanted to see a Cray in person, one of those old school cool like half moon Crays. That those things they were the lusty technology of my youth back when it was you know, computing power was so much less than it is today. That's really cool. I'm glad to see they're still in business and apparently putting out supercomputers. That's awesome.
So they had they just had the most recent top 500 list of supercomputers. And the race is tightening. The U.S. is holding on to a small lead at 33.9% of the total processing power versus China's 33.3%.
Okay.
Just into context, China holds number one and number two slot. The Sunway Taihu Light does 93 petaflops, and the Tianhe 2 does 34 petaflops. That's a lot of processing power.
Yeah, and wow.
Yeah, kind of interesting. It's really, I mean, you know, it has been increasing exponentially on what they can do. That said, the total performance of all 500 computers on the list is now 672 petaflops, which is a 60% increase over a year ago.
I would love to know what, like, the what are they getting out of that today? Like, what is coming out of those? I mean, I'm assuming that they're simulating amazing things, but at what point does that trickle down into, hey, we've got this amazing new cool thing because we simulated it on a supercomputer?
This article does not go into
that. No, I don't think any of them do. It's all really esoteric sciencey stuff. But I want to know when I can have another 400 channels of TV because of a supercomputer, darn it.
It's probably analysis of all of the emails sent worldwide, globally, by intelligence agencies.
I mean, you know, you say that jokingly, but I'm sure that there's actually probably some serious truth to the amount of data mining that is going on in clusters like that that can do all sorts of Bayesian and heuristic analyses of huge, huge data sets. I mean, you can't crunch the kind of traffic that is being captured without intense power. And it kind of makes you wonder from a conspiracy standpoint, from a conspiracy theory standpoint, if the NSA doesn't have something in the basement that puts all of the world's supercomputers to shame, that's a decade ahead of anything that we know about because of all of the smart math people.
Yeah. It's cray-cray.
In the case we're wondering, the most latest Xeon Phi or Pi 7250 is a 68-core processor that delivers 3 peak teraflops of performance.
Wow. In one die, 68 cores in one chip.
Yep.
That is crazy. That's amazing.
Interestingly, the article goes on to talk about some of the systems that are more exciting are the ones that are doing a higher percentage of petaflops per watt hour. So lower power consumption.
Sure.
Anyway, some interesting stuff in there.
That's
for
awesome.
People, you know, are doing way smarter stuff than any of us are, and that's okay.
we just talk about it. They're actually out there doing it.
That is right. That Cray XC50 is one of the ones that is doing a lot more computing power using a lot less energy,
which is a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, usually data centers, their biggest costs is power, and a lot of it is for cooling, actually. It's not so much running the equipment, it's cooling all the equipment. So if you can get more efficient machines that require less cooling, you can get more done with less power. That's the holy grail for data center construction. And they actually, there is a very real thing of building data centers. I can't remember if we talked about it on this podcast or not, but building data centers in like permafrost laden areas where they can rely on ambient cooling and basically just suck in, you know, cold outside ambient air 8 or 10 months out of the year to cool their data center, because cooling power is typically one of the largest, if not the largest, cost of operating a data center. Some of the biggest companies in the world are flocking to Arctic areas to build data centers just because of that.
Yep.
And speaking of mind-numbing numbers, I saw this and immediately thought, man, do we need to be worried? Have we checked ourselves? Adult Friend Finder was just hacked, and over 400 million 400 million accounts were exposed. Let that sink in for a minute.
I can't believe Adult Friend Finder had 400 million accounts.
So they were hacked, and apparently it revealed the account details of more than 400 million people who I'm sure would prefer to keep their identities private on the, quote, world's largest sex and swingers community site. The hacked database, which appears to be one of the largest ever single data breaches in history, apparently contains account details for numerous adult properties belonging to the California-based Friend Finder network, and includes customers' real email addresses, IP addresses, last used login to the site, and passwords. So according to the data breach notification site leakedsource.com, the passwords were largely kept either in plain text or the incredibly weak and easy to decrypt SHA-1 hashing algorithm. They claim to have cracked 99% of all available passwords, which are all now visible in plain text. So apparently 339 million accounts were stolen from adultfriendfinder.com and more than 15 million accounts from users who thought that they had deleted their accounts, but the information was not purged from the database, were also included in the breach. Interestingly, some of the exposed data shows that Hotmail is the most popular email account for users among the adult-oriented dating site. Apparently,
it's right there in the name, Hot.
It is. Hotmail followed closely by Sexy Mail. Apparently, Adult Friend Finder has confirmed that they had a vulnerability, but they have sort of dodged attempts to confirm the breach. And I missed something because now both Jeff and Todd are laughing.
No, just that. Oh, we confirmed that we had a vulnerability. After we see 400 million user accounts out on the web with passwords and plain text. Oh yeah, we did have a vulnerability.
So Diana, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce her last name right. Ballo, the vice president and senior counsel, said, quote, over the past several weeks, Friend Finder has received a number of reports regarding potential security vulnerabilities from a variety of sources. Immediately upon learning this information, we took several steps to review the situation and bring in the right external partners to support our investigation. While a number of these claims proved to be false extortion attempts, we did identify and fix a vulnerability that was related to the ability to access source code through an injection vulnerability. So that doesn't say a whole lot of anything. Apparently, it is the second major data breach at the Friend Finder network in the past year and a half. Back in May 2015, there was an exposure of about 3.5 million personal details for about 3.5 million active users of the site, including questions on their sexual preferences. I think it was a year or two ago, was it Ashley Madison was hacked, and there were all sorts of fallout from that, including, I think, one of the Duggars who got exposed as being a member of Ashley Madison and potentially doing horrible things to cheat on their spouse and whatnot. So I'm curious if there will be a subsequent fallout from the Adult Friend Finder breach. I have no idea. I didn't know that people actually use sites like this, but 400 million?
I hadn't heard of it before, but I would say that there is approaching 100% chance that at least one account is named Carlos Danger.
He may account for 2 or 3 million of those accounts because, you know. Oh, God, I want that to happen. We need to find this out. Somebody needs to look through the dump file and find how many Carlos Dangers there are there. And then
Carlos Danger 1, Carlos Danger 2.
And then can we tie them back to Wiener or not? I don't know.
Could just be copycats. But you know somebody
copycat
used it.
Copycat Senator Dick Pick Texters. there was a story that just came out today as we were recording this on November 14th, and it's one that I think is interesting because it sort of hits a little close to home with Jeff's former employer, but Amazon just announced that they are expanding their home services to 20 new cities and are also seeking home assistance. Apparently a service that they may be rolling out more, but so home service is sort of a an under the radar offering. I think, Jeff, you had even maybe talked about the fact that there was some potential lawsuits flying back and forth between the Indianapolis-based Angie's List and Amazon over Amazon signing up for Angie's List services in order to identify you know, vendors of Angie's List and then go and court them for Amazon's home service. It's basically an Angie's List copycat that Amazon is promoted. It launched back in 2015 and is now available in cities including Boulder, Colorado, New Haven, Connecticut, Indianapolis, Indiana, Trenton, New Jersey, San Antonio, Texas, as well as others. And they also are seeking applicants for a position called home assistants. Apparently, the Seattle Times reported that there have been listings in the Seattle area for these jobs, which call for applicants with hospitality or service experience, saying that they would, quote, be helping Amazon customers keep their home by tidying up around the home, doing laundry, and helping put groceries and essentials like toilet paper and paper towels away. So no word on how Amazon is actually going to potentially roll that out. And you know, with Angie's List, they're kind of suffering a little bit. You know, they've had some problems. They just had a huge third quarter loss. They've made some job cuts, and they walked away from a $500,000 acquisition bid by HomeAdvisor last year.
$500,000.
$500,000. That would have been a good deal on HomeAdvisor's part. So with Amazon, you know, rolling out this service that's very Angie's List-esque, and I realize that, you know, this is sort of Angie's List's home turf, but I mean, that's got to be some dark days for Angie's List. What are your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, I mean, I think Angie's List is on the selling block anyway, so it wouldn't surprise me to see Amazon gobble them up for the customer data and just getting rid of a competitor.
Right.
HomeAdvisor, the parent company of HomeAdvisor did put up an offer of $500 million last year, which is currently about what the stock's trading at for market cap. But they have said they're not interested anymore. Which,
interesting.
You know, whether or not that's just posturing on their part to get a lower price.
Right.
You know, I don't know. You know, Angie's List itself has said that they're using a couple of brokerage firms to look at how did they phrase it, the possibilities of leveraging something, and you know, all the experts said this means they're trying to sell themselves. You know, and you know, I can 100% confirm the job cuts.
Right,
stand behind that. The latest I heard, it was around 200, between 150 and 200. No firm numbers on that have come out, but just from the grapevine of people that I know that still work there, it's looking like it's about 150 or 200 people.
Well, and potentially with a lot more to come, like you said, if somebody does buy Angie's List, I can't imagine that there's a lot of interest in keeping 2,000 people employed in the Midwest. They would just, like you said, buy them for their assets.
If anyone buys Angie's List, it's not going to be to keep the company up running. The company is losing money hand over fist. So why would you want that? I mean, I think ultimately, if they do get bought, it's going to be for the data, and eventually everything's going to get shut down, which is unfortunate because, you know, the company has employed quite a few people in the Indianapolis area. I mean, you know, it's a nice campus. It's, you know, they've done a lot to revitalize the Near East Side, and it's unfortunate that they're in that position, but they are, and there's nothing, you know, as I mentioned last week, I have no hard feelings against them, but I also don't have any allegiance to them. I don't foresee them staying much longer.
I've been a happy Angie's List customer for years. I know nothing about fixing stuff around the house. If I can fix it in Excel, I can do it myself. Otherwise, I have to call in somebody, and often got good recommendations from them. So, of course, I guess I still can at this point, but a little nervous about it going away.
Well, just keep in mind, there are other services out there that do the same thing. So,
like Friend Finder?
It's a different kind of service.
Oh, it's a different service.
Away from Angie's List, because as long as they're still around, I would recommend using them. But, you know, HomeAdvisor does the same thing. They have a list of people that they do background checks on, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure whatever Amazon's doing, they're probably going to be doing something similar. I just, you know, it's unfortunate. You know, Angie's List went from a pay per site to a free site to try to compete with HomeAdvisor, which is a free to use as well. And so far, they haven't been able to monetize that very quickly, and they just don't have a lot of cash to run on at this point. And I just they can't afford to lose keep losing $17-20 million a quarter.
Right.
Yeah. I mean.
Now, what's interesting is I looked at a couple of articles about this today, and all of the articles did acknowledge that in this space, Angie's List is the dominant company. So, I mean, you would think that if this is a viable business model, that's got to be, you know, first mover advantage potentially, which I know they say sometimes isn't an asset, but I mean, they do say that Angie's List is still the company to contend with for these types of services. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, being an Indiana company, I've got to hope for the best, and you know, we need more high tech in the Midwest, not less.
Yep.
Go ahead, Todd.
I was just, you know, maybe going to move on. I want to hear about this potentially good news about China blocking iPhone sales.
Okay, so this is an interesting story I saw today, and I do have to warn our listeners a tiny little bit ahead of time that there, we may have to talk about some politics in this. I promise that we will keep it at a high level and not get all muckraky and mudslingy. But China has announced that they will work to block iPhone sales if Trump imposes tariffs, because apparently he has said that he, one of his campaign pledges during the run-up to the election was that he was going to institute and impose defensive tariffs of up to 45% on Chinese imports. So apparently, and also to have Beijing officially declared a currency manipulator, which I don't know that I fully understand what that means. I hear on the media that is, thems are some fighting words to be declared a currency manipulator. I don't know why those are fighting words. I'm not savvy in the financial global markets and why that's a good thing or a bad thing, but apparently that is those are fighting words. I guess there was an op-ed written by China's state-run newspaper, the Global Times, that warned the People's Republic would adopt a, quote, tit-for-tat approach, and I just wanted to say that quote because I got to say tit-for-tat, and would stop buying American goods, including Apple products that are very popular in China. Apparently, the op-ed was said to be excoriating. So that's always a good adjective. But it said that a batch of Boeing orders would be replaced by Airbus. U.S. auto and iPhone sales in China will suffer a setback. Soybeans and maize imports will be halted. They will also limit the number of Chinese students studying in the U.S. You know. Don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, that is a major trading partner of ours, and it's one of those that we have to be careful, you know, both ways. We can't let China take advantage of us, but at the same time, we can't just unilaterally say things like we're going to impose a 45% tariff. And, I mean, you know, it's a global economy that there are serious repercussions of doing something like that. The article went on to say that there are an estimated 131 million iPhones in use of China as of the end of 2015, more than any other manufacturer. And data released by the Chinese government suggests that Apple has almost 17% of the market, 16.8% of the market, a point higher than Samsung, and 1.2% more than the Chinese-based Xiaomi, which is surprising. They really seem to like their iPhone. One of the articles I looked at said that I guess right after Obama was elected president, he implemented a 35% import tariff on Chinese tires, which I do not remember, which prompted retaliatory tariffs on chickens and car exports. I mean, this was just 8 years ago, and I do not remember any of this. But apparently that happened, and both the China and U.S. suffered losses as a result. They walked back some of their tariffs and made nice, so some concerns that Sino-U.S. relations could really suffer if Trump does make good on his campaign promise. There are some big companies that work over there producing largely American goods. The article specifically talked about Foxconn, which employs nearly 1.5 million workers. That is a lot of workers, and they are the main producer of iPhones. So, you know, I guess my question from this is this just saber rattling or something that we need to be genuinely concerned about? I mean, I think the real problem is no one has any freaking idea what Trump is actually going to do once he takes the helm here in about a month, month and a half.
Yeah, it's hard to say. He's because during the speeches and such, he'll say opposing things within a few paragraphs of each other. Trade war isn't going to help anybody, in my opinion, but some of these types of things, talk about tariffs and type, you know, currency manipulation and such, obviously resonated with rural voters who have been kind of left behind in the economic quote unquote recovery under Obama. So I hope we don't go in the direction of, you know, less trade and more tariffs and such. But I mean, if it reduces Apple's influence on the U.S., that's got to be a good thing.
I mean,
he says jokingly.
But I mean, would it reduce their influence in the U.S.?
No, they make them in Mexico. Here. They just move the production to Mexico.
Well, yeah, but I predict he'll do the same thing with Mexico.
Well, okay, but here's the thing. I mean, for all of the concerns about, you know, he's not a politician, he doesn't understand, you know, the intricacies of the global stage, and he contradicts himself sometimes in the same paragraph. I mean, I don't know that you can argue that he is a completely unsavvy business person. And as
I can argue that.
But
the only
as
thing is his name.
As a business person, though, he has to understand that you can't start a trade war with America's largest trading partner, right?
Does he have to understand that? Because I don't think he's a business person. All he does is sell his name.
Well,
he's
maybe.
I'm sorry, but that is not an apt description of what he is. He is Kim Kardashian of the hotel and casino and golf course world. He sells his name and that's it. He doesn't do anything. Okay, let's stay on that.
And that's why we didn't want to get on the political soapbox. But I thought it was an interesting story.
Who knows what he's going to do? Not so much because he's Trump, but he's a politician. I mean, what politician ever follows through on campaign promises? The way the world is, they tell you anything, right, and then they get in and they do what they want. I think for him, he's going to even more so do what he wants, because I don't think he wants to be in there any more than 4 years.
Yeah.
And if you're going into a presidency and it's your first term, you have 6 months and then you're basically starting your campaign for your next 4 years, right?
Well, you're always thinking about setting yourself in a good position for the next campaign.
I honestly don't think he wants to do it another 4 years after this. I think this was kind of a let's make a point thing. Now, will he, you know, ultimately, if you asked his supporters about raising tariffs, you know, and he talked about the Great Wall and, you know, all that stuff, you know, some of that is rhetorical in that, you know, I think he's going to look to dissolve NAFTA because, I think this is what the people that elected him really want. You know, you look at locally and you had Thomson Consumer Electronics, you had Carrier, you had all these companies shut stuff down and move stuff to Mexico. You have companies building stuff in China. This is what's resonating with the people, and the reason he got elected is that he's saying he's going to bring these jobs back. And one way to do that is what he's talking about doing, increasing tariffs, making it so that building things in other countries and bringing them here will cost more than building them here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but I could see him trying to do it. And, you know, who knows, though? I mean, he's already backed down on some of the stuff that got him elected in the first place. So, I don't know. But I think that this is really something that the true reason he won the election is this people losing their jobs, people that in rural areas that don't have anything to look for and anything to do. And that combined with, you know, coal workers and, you know, it ended up, you know, costing. You know, he won Pennsylvania, he won Michigan, he won Wisconsin, and, you know, that was it.
Virginia.
You know, though, that rust belt of manufacturing, he won those votes. So, I don't know. I mean, it's...
But, you know, the reality is... So Foxconn has 1.5 million people. A large percentage of them make the iPhone. Mm-hmm. Where could you go in the world to ramp up the kind of production for the global demand for that product? I mean, look at the scarcity this release, and Apple admitted that it was a product scarcity. They can't make that anywhere.
It's going to require changes in laws in the U.S. to allow for that kind of employment, and you know, he might be willing to do that, and people might be more willing to take those kind of jobs.
My point, Jeff, is there's not enough people here to make the product.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that.
I mean, I think that they're going to turn to automation, which is going to further reduce the need for employees. And you know, ultimately, and something that really wasn't talked about this election cycle, I don't know if it'll really ever be talked about, is, you know, there are some technologies on the really near horizon that will largely, you know, shake up and be very disruptive to a lot of job sectors and potentially cause a lot of unemployment in 20 years.
If you bring those jobs back to the U.S. and you do automation, you still have to have maintenance people in those factories. You still have to have electricians. You have to have people that are good. I mean, it brings skilled jobs back to the U.S. Now,
some, yes.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I know that that this idea of, you know, bringing these type of jobs, bringing the work back to the U.S. is what won him this election. And whether or not he's going to follow through on that, yeah, who knows? I mean, no one knows. Any president goes in. I mean, what was Obama? I'm going to shut down Guantanamo. Wait, what? How many years ago?
Fair enough.
These aren't really the jobs that he was advertising, though. He was advertising jobs from 60s and 70s where you got $30 an hour on an automotive line, not $5.
I think that's going to be the lie.
Yeah, I agree.
The jobs will ever come back, but I think more jobs will come, and I think he can do it. And, you know, I understand it's a global economy, but that global economy will just as easily collapse if there's no one in the U.S. to buy the stuff. Then there's no reason to build it in China either. I mean, there's got to be some give and take.
That's true. And, you know, if nothing else, I think people need to prepare themselves for the possibility that the cheap consumer goods that we've enjoyed for a long time might be a little less cheap, depending on what happens in the future.
And I just also want to point out that it's also very easy for China to say, we're going to stop doing this, and we're going to stop doing this, and we're going to stop doing this, than it is for them to actually do it.
That's true.
Because
that's true.
Their people have gotten a taste of what middle class feels like. They have people that own iPhones and washers and dryers and can go buy, you know, Fritos chips and, you know, stuff.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
That's right. And you start taking that away from your own people, that's not good either. So, again, it's easy for China to step in and say, we're not going to let American cars and we're not going to let, you know, iPhones be sold. And then when they start doing that and they start taking things away from their people, that's not a good situation for them either. So it's a tit for tat. I do admit that I'm more concerned about Trump pissing off China than I am Trump pissing off Mexico or Trump pissing off India.
For sure.
It's easy to threaten lots of stuff, but when it really comes down to it, I mean, is China going to be willing to piss? I mean, if they say they're not going to, you know, allow any iPhones in, then that's going to cut back on the people that are working in China too. So,
right. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I thought it was an interesting story.
It is. It's,
and I guess only time will tell what happens, right? I mean, we've got 4 years to see what happens.
I don't know. I'm not ready to condemn him yet. I'm willing to give him a fair shot and see what he does. I mean, some of the things that he says are not all that controversial. Like I saw a headline today that he's gonna deport, you know, 2 million illegal immigrants. I'm like, okay. And like, why are people upset about that?
The Obama administration has deported more illegal immigrants than any other administration, including Bush's.
Is if they're illegal immigrants, they should be deported. It's right in the name, illegal.
Right, right.
If I do something illegal, then I assume that I'm going to be punished. So why wouldn't they? I don't know. I don't understand what the big deal is on that.
I think really it's more a concern of the logistics of how quickly he says he wants to accomplish it, as opposed to whether it should or shouldn't be accomplished. Yeah. But yeah. That's a, like I said, that's a logistics problem more than anything. It's, do we want to commit the resources and the money and the time to do it in, on the timetable, which, you know, I think I've heard a couple of months to a year and would cost, you know, billions of dollars. So is that a good use of the money, or should we allocate that elsewhere? And obviously those are, you know, come down to how you feel politically and where you want your money spent and all that fun stuff. But I wasn't trying
to... Yeah, there are also complications in that innocent people get swept up in it. And, you know, so there is some real human suffering to deportation.
Absolutely.
Not that we want to get into that in this show.
No, actually, I look at our timer and we've been going for quite a while. I wanted to give you a chance to touch on Average Android, Todd, because I know we did last week, but we kind of skipped over it for a couple of weeks there.
Well, I'll go over this just real quick. I found an article on you know, my favorite Android Central, and one of the reasons I like Android Central is they are willing to call out issues when they see them. This was a article by Russell Hawley. Google needs to stop shipping ideas and start shipping products. And obviously Google had, you know, a huge launch recently that we covered. And as he points out, it's hashtag eventually. Some of the examples that he gave is Google Assistant. The big thing that is supposed to take these phones to the next level is still very much beta. So like when he took it out of the box and said, hey, remind me to open the window in an hour. It said, I can't do that. I can't do that, Dave. And his name is Russell. So right there.
That was really
that's
weird.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
He said he couldn't tell him the name of a song when he asks. And so if Google Assistant is supposed to be the future, why isn't it as capable yet as Google Now? He says, I want a Google Home in every room. The speaker is great, better than any other Google Cast speaker you could get at that price. But half of the features Google showed at the launch event don't exist yet. You can Chromecast YouTube with your voice, which is kind of neat, but Netflix and Google Play Movies support are nowhere to be found. Ever since Google I.O., you hear about Daydream, which is, you know, their VR device. Mm-hmm. So far, not even LG's V20. Which FedEx is holding hostage from me. The other Nougat phone actually has Daydream support. So it's only the Pixel. So if, as long as you have a Pixel and are cool with only 19 apps while others trickle in, it's awesome. So he's saying Google has a collection of really great ideas, very attractive packaging, but precious few complete thoughts. I think the Pixel is probably the most complete of those thoughts, but... he's got concerns, even though he's excited about the direction Google is taking. It's clear that the company has an execution problem.
I mean, that's always sort of been the case. And really, unless it's a product that hits huge, you always have to worry about whether Google will maintain that long-term support. I mean, they killed Google Reader, which admittedly had, you know, not the user base of a Gmail, but it had millions of users, and they still, you know, unceremoniously pulled the plug. They've killed, I think, a lot more products than they have let stand. And, you know, there have been a lot of feature incomplete things released that then they slowly add features to over time. So that's not surprising, but that's an interesting position. I've not really stopped to think about that.
As much guff as I give Apple, they have, you know, complete hardware ideas and support. And when they release something, it's an actual finished product, more or less.
Mm-hmm. That's usually what you are paying in exchange for waiting and sometimes paying the Apple tax.
Well, plus these Google products are not just now at like the Google store on the web. They're at Best Buy. So you're advertising and packaging to, you know, non-Google early adopters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I hope they can, you know, improve on that stuff. And of course, once they have people using all these, they're great at collecting data and making stuff better. But still ways to go, I think, for Google, made by Google.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, competition's good, though. So hopefully they will figure it out. They do have brilliant people working there. So now they just need to figure out that not everybody is an IT nerd and, you know, complete some of the features before launching in on some new ones. And then I think they'll have a winning combination. Like I said, just in the 10 or 15 minutes I played with the Pixel today, I was blown away by it. So, I mean, if they can get to that point with some of their other hardware and get their software to the point where it's ready for the masses, I mean, it's a serious contender. It's nice stuff. Very cool. Well, I think we should wrap it up for today and let people get back to their week. What do you guys say?
Yes.
All right. Jeff, what is it that you love this week?
I got nothing.
Not a thing.
Guys, I have to admit I'm a little down right now.
You're not as cranky as I am.
Well, maybe. I haven't bought anything. I haven't been out to eat. I haven't done anything in 2 weeks.
I can understand. So I will give you a bump from last week. I went and saw Doctor Strange. That was what you loved last week. And I have to say, I didn't know anything about the character going in. I'm completely open to whatever it might be. And it was fan-freaking-tastic.
I
don't know if Benedict Cumberbatch is Doctor Strange, but after watching the performance, I couldn't imagine anybody else play. It's kind of like, Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. I can't imagine another actor playing that role. I mean, it was fantastic. The visuals were amazing. I mean, very mind-bending. Two thumbs crazy. Up.
It's awesome. I wish I could afford to go see it again, but I can't.
Oh, we got to get you back to work so that you can stimulate the economy. Oh.
Financially, to be honest, I'm probably good till March with the nest egg that I have, but I don't like being unemployed.
I understand.
I don't feel like I should go out and do those things.
You got to treat yourself, because when else are you going to have the time to just go watch a movie in the middle of the day?
No, that's what Wheel of Fortune, Price is Right, and Let's Make a Deal was for.
Hey, I like the Price is Right.
Drew Carey, thumbs up.
Yeah, he does a great job. All right, so Todd, what is it that you love?
So my saga with Lamal continues, and so I'll praise him a little bit. I love one of their products, the Li TV, Super Power Bank 13,400 milliamp.
So it's like another battery pack thing?
It's a battery pack.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, it's a good value. It's $25 for a pretty good amount of charge, and it's nice and compact and everything. But you do have to go through the motions. They have on their website an accessory. It's like a coupon wheel. So you spin the wheel, and you keep spinning. You can spin five times a day. You
get snapper, very tasty fish.
Yeah, the wheel of discounts. And so I got one of the $15 off coupons on the power bank. And then you have to wait for a Wednesday at 1 Eastern when they have the flash sale so that you can order it. And then about 3 days for it to show up.
I'm available really cheap right now.
But if you do all that, you get $15 off of a $40 product, and they also have a more expensive USB-C version if you're so inclined. I didn't do that yet. That's about a $60 product. So it would be, if you get the $15 off coupon, $45. But no, it works great, and I've been using it to charge my tablet, which has a pretty large battery, so I can just pop that thing downstairs and let it go for a while. It also takes a while to recharge. It's, probably about 8 hours with a little... whatever that mini USB charge is, but still it's a good product. And it was kind of novel going through all those steps and playing the game. My return of phone is in process. It's in California. So at least it was easy to return. And they've been responsive on customer service, trying to figure out how I can change my password. So their website doesn't allow me to change my password, but they're following up regularly with their customer service.
I have to say that listening to all of that, novel is not the adjective that I would use. That just sounds like a nightmare to spin the wheel of fish and then at Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for a flash. Like, can't
stand
I just...
Leg.
Yeah.
You don't understand the Chinese model. This is how they do things in China, Jacob.
I'm trying to go to Amazon and I think a couple weeks ago you mentioned a power pack for like $23 on Amazon.
Well, that's true, but it's only 10,000. This is like 30% more.
I'm good with just buying it and having it in 2 days and not jumping through all of these le hoops. That's crazy.
It's stupid.
I have to say, I do not understand the mentality of the flash sale, and I doubt that I ever will. As a uncouth Westerner, I don't get it. It's not for me. But that's interesting. And I could use a nice compact little power bank, so I might have to think on this, but I can't jump through all of those hoops. That's crazy talk. Nah, I'm too instant gratification for that. It's just not going to work.
Understood.
Yeah. So what I love is a tool that if you are an electronics hobbyist is indispensable, and if you're not, then you can just turn off the podcast right now. But it is the, I believe it's pronounced Hakko or Hakko, H-A-K-K-O, $599B solder tip cleaner. Basically, it is a little metal container. I don't know, a couple inches tall. I'm holding it up on the webcam for the guys to see next to my hand. And it's got a, it holds a little Brillo pad
type
thing.
It's like a Donald Trump.
It is Donald Trump orange. That is true.
It's orange, yeah.
It is, I just turned upside down and I spilled little solder balls all over my desk. That is spectacular. It's filled with like a Brillo pad. It's copper and it's like a little ribbon. Like I said, just like a Brillo pad without the soap in it. And what it is you clean the tip of your soldering iron off. Always before, I have used like a little damp sponge or some wet newspaper, and that cools the tip and makes it so you have to let it heat back up before you can make your next solder joints. As I have been working on my Christmas light extravaganza, I have had to make a whole crap load of solder connections over the last week. And this thing has proved indispensable. You just stick the tip of your soldering iron in, rub it into the little copper ball for a time or two, and it cleans off all of the old solder, the oxidation, and because it's copper, it doesn't scratch up and damage your tip, and it doesn't cool it off nearly as much as, like I said, a damp sponge. And the best part is, it is only $10. If you have to solder anything ever, it is $10 well spent. I will put a link to it in the show notes. That is my solid recommendation, the Hakko solder tip cleaner. It works like a champ. Yeah. So get one if you do any soldering at all, ever. Like, I don't know how I have made it my whole life without having one of these. It is the best thing, seriously. Like, I love cheap things that work really, really well, and it is one of those. So I think we are finally at the end. We've been going a long time. It's a long show this week. You have just listened to another episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. We would love to hear from you, callers. Give us a call, ask us a question, leave us a rant, whatever you want to do. You know, call and speak in tongues. We're good with that, too. You can do that at our call-in comment line. That number, as always, is 317-643-1212. Follow us on Twitter at No Better Show. Visit our blog at nobettershow.com. Send us an email. We like the old-fashioned email. You can do that at feedback@nobettershow.com. We read all listener email, and if yours is interesting, we will read it on the air and make you internet famous. Do the iTunes thing if you would be so inclined. Go and leave us a review or give us a couple of stars, or at the very least, just tell your podcast and non-podcast listening friends about us and spread the word. We would greatly appreciate it. You can do the Patreon thing if you want. That always helps us out and is much appreciated. And you can do that at patreon.com/nobettershow. And finally, consider joining our newsletter that we will send at least once a year. We can't promise any more frequency than that, but no less frequency than that. And you can do that at nobettershow.com/join. We appreciate you guys tuning in and listening this week. Hopefully, now that you have listened to the No Better Than Average podcast, you will know better than average too. Have a great week, everybody.
Nobody else going to say goodbye?
Boycott FedEx.
Boy, that's just rude. Boycott what? What are we boycotting?
Boycott FedEx.
Boycott FedEx. I could get behind a good boycott. Can we filibuster? I want to filibuster something.